The sky was so blue and the clouds so white it almost felt as if I was already in heaven. The wind on my face and the grass around me gave me courage. For the first time in a month I smiled. I wished the task ahead of me would be as easily completed as climbing the hill. I stretched out on the grass and looked at the sky, wondering which cloud would take me to heaven. Tears ran out of my eyes and onto the grass under my head. When there were no more tears to cry, a numbness settled over my body. I sat up and took one of the razor blades out of my shirt pocket. Ever so lightly, I ran the edge of the blade across my left wrist. This one, I thought to myself, would be for my failures. Switching hands, I ran the blade across my right wrist. This one would be for being gay. The tears came again, and with them a torrent of pain and anger. The same emotions that shrouded my soul my entire life, like a thick fog, muffling my happiness and ability to sustain peace. Reading from one of my books, which is called The Preacher's Son, which I decided to write a few years ago, when I was a junior in college, like 20 years ago. I decided to write a book about my life at that point in time because of some things I had experienced. I was attending Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, which, if you don't know, is Jerry Falwell's university. And, in fact, the whole reason why I was at that school was because I believed I needed to make a change in my life to change my behavior from homosexual to heterosexual. And by my junior year, I felt I'd already made that change, so I thought it'd be a good idea to put down on paper what it was like for me to go through that process. Now, as I said, I started writing that book a long time ago, and the book that actually came out of that finished, the storyline got altered along the way somewhere. Otherwise, I'd be speaking in a different building somewhere down the street. One of my first memories of life was when I was about 4 years old and I started kindergarten, and that was really the first time I was around other kids my own age, other than my four sisters and other kids in my father's church. And right away, I started noticing that I felt different. I wasn't really sure what it was, but it mostly felt like I could observe my life. I could only observe my life instead of participate in it. I wasn't that analytical in kindergarten, but in hindsight, that's what it was. I kept all these feelings to myself, but by the time I was about 7, these feelings of being different started showing themselves in one very big way. I started feeling attracted to a few of my male friends at school, much in the same way as other boys are being attracted to girls. In fact, the whole boy-girl crush thing was rampant at my elementary school like it is at every school. In fact, it was encouraged by the school, you know, teachers sitting you boy, girl in classrooms, and who's going to sit next to who on the swing set at recess. And where I grew up in northeastern Pennsylvania during the winter when it was cold, they would keep you inside for phys ed classes and teach you square dancing. Well, they do that here too, huh? So it didn't have anything to do with the cold. Well, I was always forced to square dance with Sherry Pyatt, and I wanted to square dance with Stephen Krasinowski. Although it did turn out that Cherry was a lesbian, so I was dancing with a gay person. It just wasn't the one I would have chosen. But I couldn't understand why the adults around me were stealing my choices from me. They were making me do things that felt really odd, like dancing with Cherry Pyatt. But I decided that until I saw some other boy showing the same feelings I had, hopefully Stephen Krasinowski, that I would not be the first person showing how I felt. I just didn't have the guts to do that. I'll tell you about my home life growing up. My father is a fundamentalist Baptist minister. And if you don't know what that's like, to grow up in a home like that, it's pretty much the same thing as being Amish and in the military at the same time. It's kind of like you've got electricity, but you're afraid to turn it on. And as kids growing up in that home, my four sisters and I, what that kind of a home life taught us and that religion taught us very early on was really just how to become good liars. We learned very early on as kids that every time we expressed anything that had to do with our human side, that that was always followed by judgment from our parents. So we didn't talk about anything in our home. And I certainly didn't talk to my parents about these strange feelings I was having. When I was 14, my parents took me and my sisters to church in a neighboring town, and during the sermon, the minister who was speaking got off on a tangent and started ranting and raving about this disease he had read about in a magazine that week. And he was talking about the disease that we know now as AIDS, and he started talking about the people who were going to get it. And he kept calling these people homosexuals and faggots, which were two words I had heard before, usually because it was being directed at me, but I had no clue what it meant. It just sounded bad whenever people used those words. This minister went on to give his definition of those words, and as soon as he started describing gay men, I started identifying with his description. In fact, everything he said about gay men was accurate. And everything he said about them were things that I had already experienced inside, at the least. So I decided that this must be the thing that's making me feel so different. I must be one of these people he's talking about. Then he went on to say that all homosexuals were child molesters, but now, thanks to this disease, God would be wiping them off the face of the earth. So in about 25 minutes worth of time in that church service, I got a prediction. I got a description of who I was, which was actually okay because it was accurate. But then I also got a prediction for my future, which was not okay. But because this man was a minister, there was no reason for me not to believe what he said. And so I believed him, and that led me down a very short road to becoming very depressed. In fact, every day after that, when I would get up to go to school, I just wanted to kill myself. The thought of getting one day closer to becoming a child molester and then getting a horrible disease and dying just really did not seem like much of a prospect for a happy future. About a year after I heard that sermon, I was watching one of the few television programs that my parents allowed us to watch on their cheap black and white TV. I guess when you only turn it on twice a week, there's no reason to spring for anything decent like color. But we were allowed to watch about three programs altogether during my childhood. And one program we were allowed to watch part of was Jerry Falwell's Old Time Gospel Hour show. And if you've never seen that program, you're lucky. But for the sake of information, basically a televised version of his church service. And we were permitted to watch the first half hour, which was the music part of the service, the same gig that happened in my father's church. But when it came time for Jerry to give his sermons, we had to shut the TV off. And the reason why my parents censored out his sermons was because my parents were good fundamentalist Baptists, and Jerry Falwell was an evangelical Baptist. So to my parents, as fundamentalists, Jerry Falwell was a left-wing liberal. So we were not allowed to listen to his sermons because my parents were afraid we would absorb his evangelical theology and become liberal Christians. And honestly, compared to them, we would have been liberal Christians if we would have absorbed his theology. But as kids, we were starved for TV, so it really didn't matter what was on television. If our parents said you could watch it, we would just sit in front of the TV just to watch whatever was on. And I was watching Jerry's show one Saturday when I was 15, and right in the middle of the music part of his program, he started talking about homosexuality. That usually didn't come up in the music part of the service, but that particular show, he had Florida's own Anita Bryant allegedly singing, and then also talking about... what? She sang The Old Rugged Cross in bass. I don't know what that means, but figure it out on your own. After she was done singing, you know, she went on to talk about how gay people shouldn't be public school teachers and the whole deal she was on back then, which wasn't news to me. But when she was done, Jerry came back up to his pulpit and he said some things about this subject that was news to me. He said that while being gay was a sin and a choice, it was something that God could change. Because if God was really all-powerful, which I guess is the point, if you're going to believe in God, she better be able to do stuff. If God was really all-powerful, he could certainly change somebody's behavior from homosexual to heterosexual. Well, I didn't hear condemnation or judgment coming out of that television. What I heard was hope. You know, for the first time in my life, I heard somebody telling me that I didn't have to kill myself. I could change myself. I could become like what I assumed everyone else was, and that was straight. So I decided right then and there that I would do whatever it took to get as close to Jerry Falwell as I could, to find out more about how I could change my life. All of a sudden, living life seemed worthwhile because I found out I could change mine. I wasn't sure how I'd get close to Jerry Falwell because everybody around me resented him so much, and probably not for the same reasons you might have resented him. You know, it wasn't just my parents who didn't like him. It was my teachers at my Christian high school and my friends' parents. Everybody just wrote him off. Because he was not a fundamentalist, he was an evangelical, and he really had no value in their eyes as a Christian. But I was expected by my parents to go to a religious college after high school, so I thought, well, I'll just go to Jerry Falwell's University, that'll maybe appease them, but then I'll also get my foot in the door to find out how I can change my behavior. So I made the grand announcement I was going to Jerry Falwell's University, and that did not fly. I could have come out to my parents at that point, and it would have gone over better than tell them I was going outside of our religion to get my education. In fact, they told me if I wanted to go to that place, as they called it, I would have to pay my own way. They didn't want any of their money going to him. And so I rebelled against my parents and went to Jerry Falwell's University. Found out later that for my teenage rebellion, I could have smoked pot, I could have done any number of fun things, and I wasted it on going to Jerry Falwell's University. Not that there weren't people there doing that, but I wasn't one of them. I actually graduated a year early from high school so I could get there faster. I had this intense desire to find this fix for my life, so I did everything I could to get there as quickly as possible. So I was 16 when I started out as a freshman at that school, and right away I looked for a job, which I found pretty quickly working in the yearbook office. But within the first 30 days, not only did I find a job, but I also found a boyfriend, which is not part of the student program at Jerry Falwell University. It was very difficult. You know, not only was you know, think about being in a relationship with somebody where every time you think about the other person, you think you're committing a horrible sin. Not only that, we were both attending a university where if you were suspected of being gay, you were outed on the phone to your parents and expelled. Just took suspicion and you were gone. So that created a real world of paranoia for me to live in for about 6 months, which was, of course, in addition to the world of paranoia I was living in already that I wasn't quite aware of. But after about 6 months, the relationship ended anyway, and I realized after that that I had been sidetracked. You know, I wasn't at jury school to be gay. I was there to find this fix for my life. But because I had seen so many students get kicked out of that school during the first few months I was there for being gay or being suspected of it, I no longer had faith in my original plan of marching down to the counseling center and admitting I had to struggle my life. But I found out that there is literally thousands of organizations and licensed therapists all over the place willing to help people go through this process. So I stayed a student at that school, and then I went outside the school to find my source for help. And I found a group very easily willing to help me go through this process of changing my behavior. So over the next 2.5 years, I went through the whole deal of what people now call becoming ex-gay. We didn't call it that back then, and they certainly don't call it that now, but that's exactly what it was. I was never promised I would be cured. That's not a word that's used. What I was promised is that this would be something I would have to fight every single day for the rest of my life. Well, you know, I was a good fundamentalist Baptist. I had a huge list of stuff I was supposed to fight every single day for the rest of my life. So, you know, throwing one more thing on that list made perfect sense to me. It went right along with how I already believed I should live my life, so it was very palatable. Over the next 2.5 years, as I went through this process, it was always a struggle, but I really thought I was doing the right thing, and that made it easier for me to do. At the beginning of my senior year, however, a few things started happening to me that made me start questioning some things in my life. And initially, it had nothing to do with being gay. It was just three parts of my religion that always bugged me. You know, three parts that whenever I practiced what I believed was right in those three areas, I always felt like I was doing the wrong thing. How I've been taught to treat women, how I've been taught to treat minorities, and how I've been taught to treat people who believe differently than I did when it came to religion. And so I decided I need to find out if anybody else has ever questioned what they believed when it came to this. I didn't know. So because I was at a liberal evangelical university, I could go down to the library on campus and I could find every perspective on every religion. You know, they have that there so that you can learn how to combat everybody else, but I was looking for something else. I was looking to see if anybody had ever questioned anything. And I did find what I was looking for. I found out that, of course, I was not the only person who ever challenged those aspects of their religion. But, you know, when you start that process of asking questions, maybe as some of you know, instead of getting a whole lot of answers, I ended up just having more and more questions. To the point where I started questioning everything in my life, because I realized that if I had been lied to about one thing, why couldn't I have been lied to about two things, or three things, or four things? So I started questioning everything. And I eventually got to a point where I was questioning this whole process I had gone through of changing my behavior. You know, why was I really doing it? And the more introspective and honest I was with myself, the more I realized that I was trying to change myself for the same reason anybody ever tries to do it, and that's because I had a need to be accepted. Very early in my life, I had gotten to a point where I felt that if I was not accepted by my family, my friends, and the world, I needed to change myself to make them more comfortable. And we do this all the time. You know, our society breeds this need for acceptance right into us at a very early age. And we all do things where we change things about ourselves to make other people more comfortable. Well, I had done that in this part of my life. And I realized that I did not need the acceptance of my family and my friends and the world in order for me to be a whole person and in order for me to have peace. And that right there is a place in thinking where you're not supposed to get to, in a place that I was in. And I started questioning everything in my life, and I learned that not only did I need to learn how to accept myself as a gay person, but I also needed to learn how to accept myself as a human being. My fundamentalist Christianity had stolen my humanity from me. In fact, from the time I was a little kid and could read and understand my Bible, I practiced every day that I practiced emotional suicide every morning. In fact, before my feet were even to hit the floor in the morning, I was to put my humanity to death, because that was something that was considered to be bad. So by 19, I was completely dead inside. It's a really good way to understand why there are some people in this world who can discard their gay and lesbian family members and friends without showing any kind of human emotion or remorse or feelings at all. It's because that part of themselves is dead because they have successfully committed emotional suicide. And that's what I had done. So I figured I needed to learn how to accept myself as a gay person, but I also needed to somehow resurrect, so to speak, my human side. Didn't know how to do any of that, and in Lynchburg, Virginia, there were no resources for me, so I decided I would just have to figure it out on my own. And I decided not to figure this all out while still being a student at Jerry Falwell's University. I really did not want a diploma following me around the rest of my life with his autograph on it. Although now I talk about him every single day, so that really didn't work out as I planned. I also found out I could have chucked it on eBay for about $150, so it did have some value at least. But I really decided I needed to leave school because I couldn't honestly examine the problem I was in if I was still part of it. I needed to be outside of it. And initially I had planned on leaving, graduating college and moving to California here, but I didn't have the money to do that. So I decided to move back to Pennsylvania where I grew up and save some money and then make my move. And so I moved back to Shavertown, Pennsylvania, got my job, started saving money, started working on the self-acceptance process, which was very tedious. But if you don't have anybody giving you any advice or direction, you know, where do you get your answers for your situations, no matter what they are? I had to really dig deep down inside, and that's quite odd and uncomfortable. But that's really where I started finding what I needed to have in my life as tools to free myself from my fundamentalist Christian way of thinking and living. After about 6 months, I did move to Los Angeles. It was the first 2 years that I lived there that I really felt that I finished my self-acceptance process, and I was ready to start my coming-out process, which initially I thought would just be a short list of people I wanted to tell, and that would be the end of it. Then I found out that at some point in the past, somebody had created a myth that had become universally accepted that everybody's straight. That's, of course, why people have to come out as gay, because everybody believes that other myth. I, on the other hand, assume everybody's gay and make them come out to me if they're straight. But because everybody believes this myth pretty much, I realized that I would probably have to come out in one way or another every day for the rest of my life. And that was okay. But initially I did start with my four sisters and my parents who were all still living in Shavertown, Pennsylvania, and I figured 3,000 miles would be a good buffer zone for anything that might happen. I knew that telling my family that I was gay would not make them run and get their Bibles and start changing things around in order to have a relationship with me. You know, I used to believe the same way they did when it came to religion, and I knew that as soon as I said I was gay, they would see this as a test of their faith from God, because they believe that throughout their life God sends them these little tests, and they live for the moment after they die when they're in heaven and there's going to be a big shindig. That's not the biblical term, but it's a party, and everybody stands in front of God, and for every test that you pass, well, first of all, God gives you a little empty crown, kind of like those Burger King hats, probably only a little nicer. And for every test you pass, you get a jewel to put in the crown. And the idea of the party is to get as much jewelry in that crown as you can, because at the end of the party, you turn around and give it back to God. Well, I knew that as soon as I told my parents I was gay, they would instantly think, this is a time for us to get more jewelry. Now, first of all, how gay is that whole scenario of tiaras and jewelry and, you know, I can't compete with jewelry as gay as I am. But I knew that that's how they thought, and I knew that that's what they lived their whole lives for. So they would see this not as an opportunity to grow and evolve as people, but rather a chance to get more stuff from God. And so I was not under any kind of illusion that me coming out would change anything in their minds. I knew that they would believe what they always believed. And so I wrote them all 9-page letters. I wrote one letter, went to Kinko's, but they all got 9-page letters. I wanted them to understand who I really was, because I had lied to them. I had hid myself from them my entire life. So they really didn't know who I was, and so I wanted to make sure that was very clear. And so I followed up with phone calls from the letters, and they all responded pretty much exactly as I thought they would. And that was fine. You know, religion is a choice. It's one of the few choices we get to make in life, and they had made theirs, obviously. But after a while, I started realizing that every time I would try to communicate with them after coming out to them, I was the one doing the communicating. You know, I was the one making the phone calls. I was the one making that effort. And they were always using my efforts as an opportunity to, as they would call it, witness to me and try to bring me back to whatever it was they thought I ran away from. And I started feeling the negative effects of their religious choice on my life. And, you know, they were doing and saying horrible things. They were calling me horrible names like sinner and tell me I was going to hell, and things that I would never allow a stranger to say to me. So I couldn't understand why I was allowing my parents and sisters to say those things to me. And I had developed enough self-respect and enough dignity by that point in my life that I realized that what I needed to do is not allow their religious choice to have that negative effect on my life. And I needed to walk away. And so 15 years ago, I walked away. And they, of course, have never bothered to follow me or talk to me or anything, because these are people who are willing to die for every single thing they believe in, and that includes what they believe about homosexuality. Having a gay son or brother does nothing but prove that what they already believe is true. So I've built a family of choice. I've prune the family tree, so to speak, which everybody has to do once in a while, and it's made my life a lot more peaceful and a lot stronger. When I called my mother to follow up on the letter that I sent her about coming out, the first words out of her mouth were, "Whatever you do, don't tell your grandmother because this will kill her." I guess I get my drama queen stuff from my mother. It must be hereditary. I didn't know this grandmother, my father's mother. We weren't allowed to spend any time around her as kids growing up because she was not a Christian. She wore pants. She wore lipstick. She wore earrings. And she worked for Jewish people. So to my parents, she had a first-class one-way ticket. In fact, every night as kids, when we were in our family growing up, every night we had to read the Bible and pray together, and every night we had to pray that Grandma wouldn't go to hell. Isn't that sweet? Of course, she was probably over in Harrisburg lighting candles in a circle for us because she knew that we were already in hell. But I didn't know her very well. My mom said it would kill her, so I said, okay, I won't tell her. Well, as fate would have it, a couple months later, my grandmother called me and said, I'm going to be visiting a friend in Phoenix, and I'd like to come and visit you in Los Angeles for a weekend. My first thought was that my older sister had told her that I could get her VIP seating at tapings of the Golden Girls. Then I thought, oh, well, maybe she really just wants to come and visit. So she came for the weekend, and everything was fine, except for I was doing that weird thing again. I was changing myself, because I didn't want to tell her that I was gay, because I was afraid. You know, every time I thought about saying, you know, Grandma, I'm gay, this is my boyfriend, this little movie produced and directed by my mother would start spinning in the back of my head of us loading a casket on a plane and sending Grandma back to Pennsylvania. So, well, you know, mother's words are very powerful, and that's all I had in my head. And so I didn't tell her. I didn't say anything about that. But when she got back home a few weeks later, she wrote me a letter, and she said, you know, one of the things I should have told you when I was with you is that I've known since you were a little boy that when you grew up, you would be with men and not with women, and it doesn't change how I love you. In fact, I respect your boyfriend as another grandson. Yeah. And that's, of course, why my mother lied to me and told me not to tell her, because the last thing they would want is for me to have any kind of respect from anybody, let alone a family member, for what they think is a life of sin. So when I decided to walk away from my parents and sisters, the brick wall, it was very easy for me to shift my attention to my grandmother, the woman who had been waiting my whole life to show me what real love and real family was all about. And once I started that relationship, I realized that I had never experienced that until I started that with her. I lived in Los Angeles for about 9 years, and after about 9 years, I decided that I needed to move someplace where I didn't have to fight every day of my life. Working in the corporate world, where I was working both places, it was very difficult to be out. It was okay to be gay, but it was very difficult to be out, and I figured life is too short to live that way. So I wanted to live somewhere where I felt that I could be who I was without fighting, and so I decided to move to Seattle, which is where I've lived for the last 10 years. And right before I left Los Angeles, I was in our apartment cleaning it out. I was in the closet, actually, cleaning it out. Literally in the closet. Not a metaphor. But I found a box of all this stuff from when I was in college, and in that box was that notebook of a book I had started writing when I was a junior about how I was changing my behavior from gay to straight, how I was going to marry Patty Foose and move to Ohio. And, you know, Patty, she was a nice girl. She didn't deserve a gay husband, and I didn't deserve Ohio. So I decided that I needed to finish the truth about this book. You know, truth about my life in this book. And so that notebook I eventually completed with the truth, and that became the book I read from The Preacher's Son at the beginning of this sermon. But I thought it'd be nice if people could understand what it's like for the millions and millions of kids who grow up in fundamentalist homes all around the world, not just fundamentalist Baptists, but Catholic and Orthodox Jewish and so forth and so on, because regardless of the theology, the oppression is always the same. And then also what it's like to be gay in that environment. And so when The Preacher's Son book came out, I thought it'd be nice if people would read it. But right away, I started getting a lot of letters and emails from people telling me that they were students at religious schools. They were looking for somebody who could help them, help jumpstart their self-acceptance process. They were virtually doing the same thing I had done many years earlier. And I remembered how difficult it was for me to do that alone. And so I realized that I had a responsibility as someone who had made it out of the burning building alive to turn around and go back and try to rescue as many people as I could. And so in October of 1996, I started doing outreach work, trying to reach out to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered students at religious schools who every day in this world face unbelievable things. It's not just faith-based bullying, it's persecution. And there's only one country in the whole world that doesn't allow that, and that's Canada. But other than that, every country in the world allows for the persecution of gay students in religious schools. And we knew that our work was cut out for us. So by January of 1998, myself and two other people, we founded HeartStrong, which is a national nonprofit organization to provide outreach and support to gay students at religious schools and every type of religious school that exists, and also to educate the public. We started out by forming an outreach team of two people. We got into our car, started driving around the country to do our work and raise awareness. And since January of 1998, our outreach team, which is still two people, we've just clocked over 347,000 miles doing our work. That's all self-driven car miles, not counting any flying time. We really believe our work is a rescue mission, and we cannot go far enough or fast enough because the emotional and physical lives of these students is on the line. And most of you in this room have probably at some point or another heard about gay students in public schools having some form of difficulty, either bullying or even death. But I would venture, based on what I've experienced over the last 10 years of doing this work, that most of you have never even thought, or it's never even been presented to you, what happens to gay students in religious schools, not just in this country but around the world. And that's something to think about, why you've never heard about that as well. That's why the education part of our work is so important, because unless we talk about it, usually it doesn't get brought up. In this country, as well as other countries around the world, things that happen in these schools are abhorrent. And this, you know, it goes to everything from students being outed on the phone to their parents and being expelled, to students that are called up in assemblies and chapel and outed in front of the entire school and expelled. We have students who come to us for help who are sent through electroshock therapy. If you think that that has ended, it has not. It might have ended for a lot of people in the general public, but in these religious circles, it has not ended. And it's not something that is going away either. Religious education in this country is growing by leaps and bounds, and we have students in these environments. There's literally millions of students in this country going to religious schools. In the last 10 years of doing our work, we've been able to assist nearly 1,000 students from these schools, providing hope and help to them, helping them understand that they can learn and take steps to accept themselves as they are instead of taking the self-destructive path that's offered to them by their religious schools. And for us, to have reached about 998 students in 10 years is a huge thing, because we're a small organization, we have no money. To have reached that many people is incredible, but we know that it's actually a very small number, because there are hundreds of thousands more who need to hear our message. So our goal is to reach one more student as often as we can with what we're given to do it, and that's exactly what we do. HeartStrong is a social justice organization. We're not religious. We're an educational nonprofit. If nothing else, before you leave today, stop by the table in the next room and get one of our newsletters to find out more about this important work. In fact, California is the state with the most religious schools in this country. Twice as many schools, twice as many students. And ironically, San Francisco County has twice as many schools and twice as many students as any other county in this country. So we do quite a bit of outreach work in this state as well. When I first started doing work with HeartStrong, I started noticing that the only religious groups that would allow me to stand behind a pulpit on a Sunday morning and share about my work were Unitarian groups. The gay churches and the gay-friendly churches just would not allow me to speak because they didn't have a religious agenda, because HeartStrong isn't a religious organization. But I didn't know much about being a Unitarian except for what my parents had taught me. Feel free to raise your hand as you fit into the category as I describe them. They told me that Unitarians are a bunch of hippies. Yeah, it's okay. So they weren't totally inaccurate. They're a bunch of hippies who sacrificed things in the mazes behind their church buildings, which I think they're talking about the labyrinth and some perhaps Wiccan things. So, but you know, they call it a maze because everything's a puzzle to them. But anyway, it didn't really matter to me what people believed. I was there to talk about our work and was grateful for that opportunity. But one Sunday morning, I was in Macon, Georgia, about to speak at the High Street Church there, and they had a big poster in the lobby that said what Unitarian Universalists think or don't think about God. And as I read that, I realized that I was not alone. Somebody brought this up during Joys and Concerns. It was the first time I'd ever seen that there was other people who felt the same way that I did. Up until that point, I thought I was a rebel and on my own and all that stuff, but apparently that wasn't true. There was enough people who felt like I did to print a poster. And that started me on my journey to becoming a Unitarian. And a few years ago, my grandmother did a family tree, which takes us right back to President John Adams, who was a well-known Unitarian of his time, which I guess my one responsibility in life must have been to bring the family name back around to the left. So I've done that, so I can move on. But you know, one of the great things about the work that we do is most of the groups that I speak to are not Unitarian groups, and I always get asked questions about my own journey and spirituality and such, so it gives me an opportunity to talk about how I found personal peace. And I always tell people that the great thing for me about being a Unitarian as opposed to what I used to be is that instead of walking into a building like this and having to be something, I can just walk in and I can just be. And I think that's what being a Unitarian is all about. And just in closing, when I was a kid in my father's church, he used to have these missionaries show up, and they would unload all their stuff on a table in the back of the church, you know, usually snake skins and shrunken heads and stuff. They said they were there to scare the hell out of us, literally. It worked. But then they would get up and talk about their work, try to raise money, pack it on their car and leave, and my sisters and I would stand by the side of the church and point and laugh and say, what a horrible, cheesy life that is. We've got a table in the other room, we've got a car in the parking lot. Probably shouldn't make fun of people for what they do, even though our work is much different than those culture-destroying missionaries that came to my father's church. My words, not theirs. It's still the same thing, so don't make fun of people for what they do, or somewhere in the universe, something will make sure that you're doing something similar. That's what I found out. But there's one thing everybody can do that helps HeartStrong. You know, if you can't do something with the things that are on our table, you can tell people about our organization. You know, take our newsletter and give our website to people, because you never know, by passing on information, how you might make it easier for somebody to find us who needs our help. And I hope in some way today I've been able to give you a little bit of education about some things, and also maybe give you some ideas on how you can leave light in the world that you live in. Thank you very much.